For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as in a cave. We invite you now to join us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, and Joseph Tomasian. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
And welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Joseph Tomasian, with Tim O'Donnell, and two of the three of us are clean shaven today. Tim, you have lost your cave beard.
Right.
Yes.
And I'm sitting with a bunch of small men right now.
Yes.
Right. Without beards. Beardless men.
Right. Beardless men, exactly.
Right. And you are
more than dashingly handsome with your
It's been 10 years, over 10 years now with the beard.
Yeah, now yours is neatly trimmed, which is, I have to admit, kind of rare.
Yeah. There's a lot more gray in it.
Well, a little bit more gray, and like I said, you very often wear much more bushy.
You
go for that sort of ungroomed, unkempt
right,
sort of look.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great picture.
Like a Viking.
Yeah. That's a great picture for the people who don't know what we look like.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you know, Tim, you've lost 10 years by losing your beard, to be perfectly honest.
All right, there's an advantage. Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting how appearance, though, does sort of affect our own reality to a certain extent. I mean, when you lose the beard, and I mean, I've dabbled with growing facial hair. Problem is, I guess I don't have.
Can you grow it fully?
No, I really can't. I've tried after a few months. First off, my family hates it. So my wife hates beards. My daughters hate beards. So therefore, that just sort of cinches it right there. But when I have tried, I mean, it comes in with lots of spots and spotches.
Yeah,
and it just doesn't come.
That's no fun for anybody.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's like a lack of testosterone in my life or what, but.
You know, there's medication for that.
Right. There's pills. There's pills for everything.
So, but on the question of appearances and reality and sort of what makes something real, that especially when we're talking about issues of gender, when we're talking about issues of does the beard make the man, does the lack of the beard make the woman, those are topical questions these days. And so maybe there's some philosophical questions kind of behind those to dive into.
I think it begins with which philosophy you're going to ascribe to. And I had a conversation this past weekend at a client's home, and we were discussing, as I do with my clients, philosophy. And and she made the statement. It was a leading statement, more of a question in there, but she presented it as a statement that all philosophies are basically the same. And I thought, oh my gosh. She's an IT professional, and so not taking philosophy classes, and so I can rightly excuse her of that misnomer, that or that lack of understanding that philosophies are drastically different from thinker to thinker.
Right. And there's some people that they kind of say, I've never really formally taken a philosophy class, therefore I don't have a philosophy.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's almost impossible to not have a set of sort of philosophical presuppositions that you're bringing to just about anything. So, when you say, all philosophies are equal, first off, that's obviously not true. Second, people have their own philosophies that they don't even realize are there in the background of sort of shaping their thinking and guiding what they're thinking.
I think when you're talking about everybody having a philosophy, a part of that is really helping a person to understand that the way in which they interact, the way in which they see the world, the lens through which they experience life and relationships is unique to them. And not everybody's going to have the same experiences. And so understanding that something that one person holds to be sacred and true and real is either, that's accurate, or it's atypical because of their experiences. So they may think this is just how everybody sees the world, how everybody understands it, but it's either typical or atypical. And if it's atypical, you know, there could be a mental pathology, or they could just have had a crappy childhood.
Yeah, and I'd go even a step stronger than that. I mean, there's a rightness and a wrongness.
Sure.
I mean, you're either correct about things or you're wrong. I mean, it goes beyond just being typical and atypical, I guess.
Well, you know, I guess I don't want to put right and wrong on somebody's subjective experience of, you know, an abusive father. You know, oh, my dad was great, but he was abusive. Well, was he great then?
Yeah.
It's hard to.
And you're right. Subjective experience. That's one of those things, and it gets a little annoying sometimes in life, because things that get claimed to be subjective are very often not, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, this is the way I feel. It's like, honestly, the way you feel about something doesn't make it one way or the other. The way you feel about reality doesn't change reality. So the subjective sometimes gets thrown out there.
I don't like Orange Fanta, therefore it's evil. Well, no.
Yeah, exactly. But that's my subjective experience. Right? But, don't tell me what's right and wrong, because that's the way I feel about it. I mean, I feel that Fanta is evil, right?
Yeah. It sounds like, though, when you're talking about philosophies, are you also thinking, it came to mind two other terms maybe that were maybe are interchangeable with that these days. One is like a worldview. So everyone has a kind of worldview.
Yeah.
The other one is like a Charles Taylor. He calls it like the social imaginary, which is a bit of an awkward term, but it's that set of everyone as an adult, at least you have these commitments about developed to different degrees, person to person, but you have commitments of understanding of how things are in general, so you can make your way through your day.
Yeah, I mean, we can never have a completely synoptic view of all of reality.
Right.
I mean, that's just not part of the human experience. We can't do that. So all of us are going to have certain presuppositions that we have to make to be able to operate. Running in the background, right? And so those, I think, kind of form a baseline set of
I've heard presuppositions. Them called basic beliefs. Like basic, you have basic beliefs about how...
You know, they may not even be beliefs. I mean, they may not even be conscious understandings of things. They may just be things that you kind of have to accept to be able to operate. Some of them are logical.
So what I'm hearing is there has to be a starting point from which... We have conversations about what is real, what is not real, what is typical, what is atypical, what is good, what is evil.
Right.
There has to be a starting point.
And we have to be able to analyze it, right? I mean, we have to be able to kind of uncover, I think, the sort of subconscious presuppositions that we're making. And then we have to analyze them. And that really is sort of the work of philosophy, or at least one of the works of philosophy. I don't want to say it's the work of philosophy, as if that's what philosophy is all about. But a lot of it is uncovering those sort of hidden presuppositions, bringing them to the forefront and analyzing them. And
defining your terms. So language is going to have a huge role of importance here.
Right. Because language is how we express reality. It's how we express our beliefs. And it's how we express what's true and false. And, you know, I guess the ontological status, use the big word ontology. So
what's ontology mean?
Yeah, so ontology, it means the... It literally means the account of being, right?
Yeah.
So it literally means the account of being. So, but it's really the level of existence that something has. You know, to what extent is it real? To what extent does it exist? To what extent is it imaginary? All of those are what a philosopher would call the ontological status of something. And also, how is it connected to other things, right? So, you know, being bearded and being unbearded, you know, that has a certain connection to being a man. But what is that connection? That's part of the ontology around what a beard actually is. You know, is it an accidental feature of a person, or is it essential? Is it necessary? Do you have to have a beard to be a man? You know, those are a little bit of a silly question. But,
well, not particularly. In the ancient Romans were beardless. They shaved, even though they could very well grow beards, because having a beard, a barba, made you barbarian, right? That made you other. And so even to this day, within the Roman Catholic Church, it is it's not a law or a rule, but if you're going to be a priest within the Catholic Church, it is typical to be clean shaven unless you belong to a monastic order, because that, you know, belonging to the monastic order will set you apart as others. So is there something ontological about being bearded? If we say yes, that makes me more of a man than others who are unbearded. And
I think you're right. Part of the ontological truth of males is that they have the capacity to be bearded, and it's incidental whether or not one grows one or not. That's how I would look at it.
Well, I mean, a lot of women have the capacity to be bearded as well.
I've seen it, you know, God bless her.
But one would say women, I think a distinction would be for women.
It's atypical.
They have they would have capacity. Most women, right, are going to have a capacity for some facial hair. Mm. For a woman to be bearded, one would say that's atypical.
That's atypical. But once again, I mean, if you're talking about potentiality, that's potential. Yeah. I mean, it's there. So, you know, that beardedness necessarily goes along as a sort of essential possibility for maleness. I'm not sure, but
and I would say,
because I think there are men that can't grow beards. I was just explaining my difficulties growing a beard. Yeah. So I don't feel less of a man because I can't grow a beard.
Well, and a lot of this is coming from we enter most of our conversations here in the Catholic Cave from a fundamentally Thomistic perspective. You know, that it seems to be the
philosophy. Because that's the best.
Well, it's the philosophy.
That's what I say.
It's a most excellent philosophy that we can use because Thomas Aquinas was so very clear and succinct in his definitions and how he described things, and it's orthodox, but it doesn't mean that is better fundamentally than other.
And also doesn't. I mean, I think this is important to say.
Even though I'm a Thomist,
say there is no promise of protection of inerrancy around Thomistic thought. There's nothing that says Thomas wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
About certain things or about particular things.
And some of his Aristotelian views, you know, we could look back and say, well, that's just not that accurate.
Right, exactly. So, you know, St. Thomas, though, is sort of if not the preeminent philosophical
mind.
Right,
he's the gold standard.
He is the gold standard.
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, when you're arguing, you're always going to be kind of arguing within the context of Thomism, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's not room for argument there. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about, I think, ontology, and then maybe we'll dive into a couple of different perspectives other than Thomistic ontology when we get back right here on The Catholic Cave.
Are you a still being? Maybe in motion, but not going anywhere. Maybe it's time to try being still. We help you focus on what's most important. Catholic Radio Indy.
Do you like game shows? How about trivia? You're listening to Catholic Radio, so I assume you're interested in the Catholic Church. Catholic Challenge 2.0 is the newest addition to our programming lineup here on Catholic Radio Indy. A 30-minute quiz show covering almost everything Catholic. Catholic Challenge 2.0 tests your knowledge and teaches at the same time. Check it out every Thursday afternoon at 4:30 right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Joseph Tomasi, and here with Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. We are discussing ontology and how people have particular worldviews when it comes to ontology, meaning we all experience the world through our own lenses, and what may feel real or seem real to me may not be a universally experienced event in other people's lives. And so I think we left off in the last segment where we're talking about St. Thomas Aquinas. He's the philosopher part. Excellence within the Roman Catholic Church, and his philosophy is the most fundamental studied within seminaries, and much of the way in which we teach comes from St. Thomas Aquinas, whose branch of philosophy we refer to as Thomism. And in this Thomistic worldview, we tend to have these ideas that exist at the top. You know, I think Plato would call it the form, right? Mm. And Aristotle would call it the good. And others in the Christian context would say, well, it's God. And so there's this universal idea, this universal goal within Thomism that the individuals, the persons that make up the church, that make up the community of believers, are moving towards. So within that context, you know, he has his Summa Theologica, which is this great work of distinctive systematic theology and philosophy of how the world is and experienced and viewed by Catholic Christians, right?
Right. Somewhat, yeah. I mean, I think Thomas is the gold standard. And, you know, that's where this Catholic cave kind of came from, Tim. You and I were sitting around kind of talking about the idea of worldview. It really came out of the idea. Yep. I think I'd been to a Protestant worldview seminar where they were talking about, you know, the biblical worldview. Yeah. You know, honestly, obviously, the way Catholics see the world is very much shaped by the Bible. It's very much shaped by our belief in God. But it's not that biblical worldview, I think, mm-hmm. that the Protestants talk about. So we were talking about, well, how do we teach people, I think, a quote-unquote Catholic worldview? And mm-hmm. we said, well, honestly, the most fundamental Catholic worldview is the teachings of St. Thomas. I mean, that sort of does form the Catholic worldview to a certain extent. But, you know, honestly, it hasn't always been that St. Thomas was this universally accepted, acclaimed champion of Catholic thought. His propositions, I think 27 of them, were condemned as heretical. He wasn't rehabilitated until, you know, about 30 years of debate back and forth, because, you know, what he was incorporating was pagan philosophy mm-hmm. into Christian thought at the time.
Not that philosophy didn't have a role within Christianity or Christian thinking.
Honestly, that was kind of part of the question. Does philosophy have a role within Christianity? Because yeah. a lot of people in Thomas's day were kind of saying, no, not really, well, honestly.
St. Paul kind of seems to call philosophy into question, right?
So. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and you know, St. Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican. And the main fault lines of this debate that took place during the life of St. Thomas really cut across the line of the two mendicant orders. So mm-hmm. in some ways you had the Dominicans on one side following Albert the Great and St. Thomas's Dominicans. Mm-hmm. And then you had Franciscans on the other side. St. Bonaventure was kind of the great, I think, exponent of the day. And there were a lot of points of differences. And so to try to boil it down into a simplistic formula for what the big differences between like St. Bonaventure and St. Thomas Aquinas. And notice in both of those, I introduced this as saint. And both of them, I'm not sure if Bonaventure has ever been declared a doctor of the church. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I thought. You know, so both of them have been declared doctors of the church. And yet, I mean, they had very different, quote unquote, worldviews. Yeah. Even within the Catholic Church. So, there are big fault lines. It wasn't always that St. Thomas was kind of the Catholic worldview, but historically and inevitably, you know, I think he did kind of win the day on incorporating Aristotelian philosophy into a great deal of our understanding of the faith.
Well, 800 years on, he's still, you know, the philosopher that informs Roman Catholicism and our catechism and the way in which we worship and how we view sacramentality all comes from a fundamentally Thomistic mindset. And so in order to press this idea, you know, we have the distinctions from Thomism, substance and accidents, form and matter, particulars and universals, which just to give some definition of these things, you know, the substance is the being of a thing, and the accidents is what makes up the physicality of it. You know, accidents could be tall, short, skinny, fat, bearded, not bearded, but substance can't be male and female, can it? Or I'm sorry, accidents can't be male and female, can it?
I don't know. I mean, if you're talking about a human person, you're still a human, whether you're a male human or whether you're a female human. It doesn't change your essential humanity by being male or female. So, I mean, and honestly, that does get into a question that these same Franciscans and Dominicans argued about after the life of St. Thomas a bit. And that is the sort of ontological status of accidents versus versus substances.
Sure.
And that comes down to sort of the idea of universal. So as you said, you know, St. Thomas saw the world starting from a sort of unitary goodness. I think that's a fundamental. I think that's a fundamental of Catholicism that pretty much all Catholic thought has to start there. That there is God one
is,
God.
Yep.
Yeah, there's one
all
God.
All things came through Jesus.
Right. And everything was created and came from this one God, yes. Right? But how I guess we organize that and why we organize that into this Porphyrian tree. So Porphyry was the Greek philosopher that came up with a logical sort of set of what he called notes for how to describe anything. And at the top, you had the most general and honestly, St. Thomas and Bonaventure and the other Franciscans would agree, you know, the most general is being or God, as St. Thomas. And that's that's a distinction we'll have to talk a little. Is there a distinction between being and God? We'll have to talk a little bit about that. But anyway, the most general, all the way down to the most specific, which would be an individual of a particular species. So, you know, we've got men, we've got women. That's a little bit more specific because you've got, you know, two sexes of human beings. And then you've got individuals. And those individuals then exhibit characteristics. And so how those are related, though, you know, how the top being is related all the way down to the individual of a particular species is an interesting ontological question that came to the forefront in discussing St. Thomas, because St. Thomas basically said that there is a real distinction between the universal and the individual. In other words, there is such a thing as man, and what man is instantiated, it comes into existence in a material form in an individual. But
he talks about the ontological hierarchy, right?
Right.
Where God is uncreated, uncreated spirit, and then there's the angels, which are created spirit, and then there's humanity, which is spirit and flesh, so stuff, right? And then there are the animals who are spiritless, but fully flesh, and then there's plants, and below that you have minerals and rocks and things like that. And you know, the nature of Christ's sacrifice elevates us above the angels, below God, and so that ontological change, because of our baptism, it creates a more substantial presence to our ontology, right? And so when we're talking about humans and the individuality, there's still a goal, right? They're still aiming upwards. They have this universal, they have God, who is the source of being. We participate in God's being. And so all things are moving back towards God. So we come from God in this exitus and move back towards God in this reditus. Everything is oriented towards God. And the capacity or the degree by which we do well in moving towards God, or the lack of, we call sinfulness, right? And so if everything isn't moving towards God in to the fullest of one's capacity, it's due to sinful nature, Thomas would say.
And I think that's a pretty good, accurate description of what Thomas says, because Thomas is taking a lot of his he's taking a lot of his nomenclature, he's taking a lot of his description of this from Aristotle, and so he's using basically the philosophical apparatus of Aristotle to try to describe Christian belief and Christian thinking.
Yeah.
So, you know, in some ways, you know, St. Thomas is one of those philosophers that he is a system builder. He's building a whole system of thought. But because he's a Christian and Catholic thinker, he's doing it for a very different reason. He's doing it to try to explain the faith.
Yeah.
So he's using philosophy as a handmaiden to theology, as he said, where Aristotle was just simply trying to explain the way things appear.
Yeah.
The way the world looks and appears to him. And so there's a slight difference in the way St. Thomas, I think, utilizes Aristotle. But by and large, I feel like he does a pretty good job of keeping Aristotle's philosophy more or less intact.
I would agree.
Yep.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room to see the compatibility between Aquinas and Aristotle, especially in the terms you were bringing up, Joseph, around substantial forms and accidents, potentiality and act. Those are all super important.
Yeah,
we're talking about. But weren't you kind of getting at, and it'll come up on a break here, weren't you getting at, Mark, though, sort of the difference between universal and particular, like whether or not particulars, like human, a specific individual, whether or not they share in or have a common human nature?
Well, it's not so much whether they have a common human nature. It's whether that common human nature is really distinct in a real way from the individual. So that's sort of the question. Well, we'll come back to that because I think that's got implications for a lot of sort of very contemporary modern problems that we're facing. And it's a deep philosophical question within Catholic thought, but we'll get to that when we come back right after the break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Whether things really are crazier than ever, or we just have more ways to hear about it all, it can be a little overwhelming at times. When that happens, remember the Apostle Paul's words from Holy Scripture. Do not worry about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Thank you for being a Catholic Radio Indy listener.
It's not just a radio station, it's a ministry.
Catholic Radio Indy.
You guys just have no idea how much of a difference it makes.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Joseph Tomasian and Timothy O'Donnell, and we were just getting into the weeds a little bit there before the break.
we do that,
yes. Yeah. So, but I think to move forward a little bit, let's take a step backwards, and let's look a little bit at a little bit more at Thomistic philosophy, because, like we said, you know, St. Thomas really is sort of the gold standard of how Catholics understand these things, and he does use Aristotelian language to discuss it. And a lot of these terms that Aristotle uses are foreign to modern audiences. They very much, when you're talking substance, accident, potentiality, actuality.
And they're just not words people use.
Differences between essence and existence and being, you know, those all have differences in meanings when you're looking at it from and you know, this is where scholasticism really gets a bad name, right?
I mean, sure.
You know, scholasticism was looked down upon as a bunch of theologians sitting around arguing about how many angels can fit on the head of pin, which, by the way,
zero.
And I was going to say, no serious philosophical discussion that I've ever found really
I've never been interested in that question.
No, and I don't think any Catholic philosopher or theologians really all that interested in that question. But there are
it was a straw man argument.
Yeah, but there are questions like that. There are questions like that that I think to you know, the general public do sound like these are distinctions of very minute importance, but they have huge implications when you're looking at the overall background. So
you were talking about individuals.
Right, exactly. And that's where we're going to go. The relationship between the universal and the individual. And so...
So let's quickly define what the... In this conversation, what is the universal?
Sure, sure. Yeah, so it goes back to Aristotle. Aristotle basically said that to understand something, you have to understand it's sort of the four ways that it came about. Mm-hmm. It's four causes, as he said. And they really are more ways of coming about than they are sort of causes or reasons for something to exist.
Right, right.
And so the first way something comes about is materially, right?
What's it made of?
What's it made of? Exactly. So how did this table come to be? Well, it's a bunch of wood, right? So, you know, the material cause of a table is the wood. Then you have the formal cause, and that's really where this discussion
sure.
revolves around. The formal cause is sort of the limits and shape that matter can take in Aristotelian thought. So when you're talking about a table, the form of the table is the shape that has informed
rectangle,
that matter.
Oval.
Rectangle, oval. You know, legs,
yeah.
Legs, flat surface, etc.
The word I've heard used that helps with that, I think of it as like a blueprint. It's the blueprint or pattern of a thing that makes it what it is and not something else.
Okay. Yeah.
So you think of a table,
right.
You're going to have a blueprint for what the table is going to look like.
Formal cause equals blueprint.
Right. And, yes. And once again, distinctions are important, though.
Yeah.
And I think this is important, that blueprint comes across more as the Platonic idea of something.
Sure.
And Aristotle disagreed with that idea, that there was such a thing as a blueprint that had an actual existence outside of the table. Or I guess if it did exist, it had a very separate existence of its own as a blueprint and not as part of the table.
The
form of the table always exists within the matter of the table.
Sure.
The two are inseparable. You can't pull the form out of the matter and have the form still existent. And that's...
You've only given three causes.
I've only given two.
Two.
But yeah.
So you got to do efficient.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Final.
So the third, right. So the third cause is the efficient cause. And that is the actions that bring the table to being.
The carpenter.
Initial, well, or the action of the saw or the sawmill or you know, so that action that brings it together. And then the final cause is the purpose of it, right?
Yeah.
It's teleological, right? So the
telos.
Telos, exactly. So,
and
that's the reason that it can, so for a table, it would be for sitting at and for placing things on top of. That's the reason. And you can't have something that's a table if you can't do that with it, right? I mean, that's why you can't have round tables, because you can't put glasses on round tables. So a round table...
Like a ball.
Like a ball. Right.
Is a not spherical a table.
A
spherical table.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously you can have a round table.
I can definitely put a glass on a round
table.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, a round table has a flat surface, but that flat surface... That's kind of intrinsic to the purpose of a table, right?
Well, it's essential, I think you would say.
Right, right. It's essential. So those are the four causes, and you have to understand kind of all four of them to really grasp kind of what a thing is. So now going back to the individual, as we were saying, everything that exists is this combination of, and this is in Aristotle's view, is this combination of matter and form. So it is the limits and shape that the matter can take and how that matter is put together, and that's the form. And the two are linked. There's no way to kind of take one without the other, except in our own intellect.
And so
intellectually, we can abstract form from matter so that we can have this understanding. And that abstracted form of what we see is what Aristotle calls the universal.
Yeah.
So the universal is the abstracted form that happens in the human mind, possibly when you get to Christian philosophy in the mind of God as well. But that abstracted form then is the universal of it. And it is what allows us to understand that this table and that 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 table are all tables, right?
They all participate in tableness.
Uh-huh. They all have the same four causes.
They wouldn't have the same four causes.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. Good point. You're right.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. They'd have the same form. They would have
Because you can have different materials, a wood table, right. steel table.
Exactly.
So and you can have different efficient
different carpets, right, exactly. Yeah. Some of them are manufactured. Some of them are handcrafted. I mean, yeah, you've got different efficient causes of tables.
Mm-hmm. So would you argue that all created things have or participate in each four of these causes?
Well, Aristotle would. Yeah, uh-huh. yeah, Aristotle certainly would.
Would Thomas?
Thomas, I think, would mm-hmm. agree. Yeah.
Do you think?
No, I absolutely agree.
I agree too.
Yeah. I would. So when you're talking about an individual, then for St. Thomas, what you're talking about is that universal is made concrete. It's made I won't say existent being, because the universals have existence of their own.
Sure.
But, it's made into a concrete being by being enmattered, by being incorporated.
Enfleshed.
So it's matter that then differentiates a universal into individuals.
So we have the efficient cause of, as humans, what is it?
So the efficient cause of humans?
Mm-hmm.
Reproduction.
Reproduction, yeah.
Mom and dad.
Mom and dad, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a dangerous question to ask, especially on air. I'm like, I don't know how in detail we want to go into this question.
Yeah. Material cause would be flesh and bone.
Right.
Formal cause would be...
But I think you could also say our DNA. You know, yeah, I mean, sure. I mean the, you know, you, it, honestly, it is, yeah, it is the sort of pattern and shape that our bodies take. So it's mm-hmm. our soul, but it's more than our soul as well. I mean,
but the most important one, final cause,
each
right. person's.
That's where there's a lot of purpose. Disagreement these days.
Right,
in the world.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So final cause is often dismissed.
Right, and this is, I think this is one place where you could say either St. Thomas flat out disagreed with Aristotle, or St. Thomas took Aristotle and had to manufacture Aristotle into a good Christian to come up with sort of an answer to that final cause of humanity. But, you know, the final cause of humanity, as the Baltimore Catechism, is to love, serve, and honor God in this life and the next. I mean, you know, that's that is sort of the Catholic understanding of the final cause. And St. Thomas certainly wasn't going to disagree with that.
Sure.
Yeah. But... The question that comes up in all of that, though, is this notion that it is matter that differentiates the individuals, and therefore the universal has a sort of different ontological status, right? Mm-hmm. It's its own reality, separate from the individual, because it can exist on its own in other individuals. In other words, that same universal can be, or that same form to a certain extent can be enfleshed. That's the word you used. Yeah. It can be enfleshed by taking on different matter. And that I think is a sticky point in St. Thomas's in St. Thomas's philosophy to a certain extent.
I don't know that you can have an authentic conversation in a Thomistic context about modern world problems, because final causality is going to be fully dismissed, and material causality is going to be watered down.
But I really think in the modern context, I think the difficulty in using St. Thomas's language and using scholastic philosophy to talk to modern audiences really goes to that connection between form and matter. Most modern philosophy, and I would say most everyday people out there, because they've adopted modern philosophy as that sort of background understanding of things, dismisses the idea of universals completely.
Sure.
Right. They say universals, they would agree with William of Ockham, right? So William of Ockham was a,
Augustinian.
He was Augustinian. I was going to say, I knew he was a monk of some sort. But he was a,
What would you say, 13th century?
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah 13th, 14th. 14th. Yeah, I think 14th yeah. century. A couple hundred years after St. Thomas. Yeah. Anyway, but he looked at this relationship between universals, and he came to the conclusion that most modern people say of this is just the way our mind organizes things, right? We see dogs, and we see there are some dogs with curly tails, there are some dogs with cropped ears, there are some dogs that are big, there are some dogs that are little. And each of these individual dogs, then we look at the we take the common characteristics and we categorize all of these creatures as dogs because they have certain attributes in common, and then we slap a label on it of dog. Mm-hmm. But that label dog really doesn't have any existence at all outside of the individual species. Sure. So there's no universal concept of dog. You just have a bunch of dogs that our minds categorize as dogs. And that philosophy is called nominalism. Yeah. And in modern philosophy, that really is the philosophy that has kind of won the day. So are those the only two possibilities? No, those are not the only two possibilities. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back after the break here on The Catholic Cave.
Like coming up for air, like a time of rest after a big race, like a good meal after a long day. Jesus, what you need, just when you need him. Catholic Radio Indy.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
When a business is looking to expand, they say it's all about location, location, location. But what about when the church needs to expand? To stretch out and reach those fallen away, estranged from the faith, or those who simply have never heard the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Then it's all about vocation, vocation, vocation. We need more people dedicated to the mission of serving the church, more priests, more deacons, more men and women of vowed service, and more lay workers willing to go into the fields. The harvest is rich, but the workers are few. Is God calling you to service? Pray on it, and while you're there, pray for more vocations. A simple request from your friends at Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Joseph Tomasi and Timothy O'Donnell, and we are talking about the differences between individual things and universals and what that distinction looks like. And on the one hand, we were talking about the sort of perennial philosophy of St. Thomas that says universals are their entities of themselves, right? They are forms that inform matter and create individuals by becoming enfleshed. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you have sort of the modern view of things that no, universals are just categories of the mind. This is the way our mind works. It's the way things are categorized. And there's a third way, though, to understand the relationship between universals, and that comes from the philosophy of Duns Scotus. So Duns Scotus was a late 13th century Franciscan, and so he was brought into this huge debate between the Dominicans and Franciscans, and it was kind of the heir of St. Bonaventure of arguing that the Dominicans were wrong in some way. I think that, it's kind of funny because you look at the orders and you say, why do Franciscans and Dominicans exist? Well, on the one hand, Franciscans exist because of St. Francis and trying to follow the pattern of complete simplicity. The Dominicans exist as the order of preachers education, etc. I really do think there's an argument to be made that Franciscans and Dominicans exist just simply to argue with each other. But
everybody needs an enemy.
Right, exactly. So Duns Scotus was the Franciscan that was sort of the heir to Bonaventure. And in this debate between nominalism and And the formal, realistic formalism or formal realism, there we go, formal realism of St. Thomas. He said that no, the this distinction is what he called a formal distinction. So it's not a real distinction. There's not this absolute separation between humanity and what a man is and what it means to be mm-hmm. human and each individual. But he said that there's an ontological reality to the individual as a universal in and of itself.
Right.
So that the universal and the individual go together, and that there is no sort of universal category mm-hmm. that doesn't incorporate each individual distinctly. And he called this hesitas, right?
Hesitas.
It
means thisness.
Exactly. Yeah. The thisness of each individual thing.
And I think it's important to slow it down and really describe what that means for the everyday person. Within Thomism, basically the structure is set up where you have individuals, some with some gifts, others with other gifts. Let's bring it to a real world example. If I have a 4-year-old son, he just turned 4. He has a genetic disorder, and so he's not capable of hitting the milestones when they are quote unquote supposed to be met. And so we would look at that and say there is a lack to his person. You know, he is atypical. When a person is homosexual, we would look at that individual through a Thomistic lens and say that their feelings, their emotions are disordered. Not to say that they're less than, but to use Thomistic phrasing, their final and material cause were not being utilized towards what they're supposed to, you know, the should. It's not that way with, I mean, it would be like using a screwdriver to open a can of paint, which can be used, but I mean, a screwdriver is meant to.
Right. It's got a different purpose.
It's got a different purpose, a different final cause. Whereas within Scotesian philosophy, he says, no, there's not a universal that a person should not be shoulding themselves. I should do this. Your created atypicality is exactly how God created you. And so it gives a sense of fullness to the individual, which was a drastic change from Thomistic philosophy. And because of that, there are lots of, and now understand, listeners, Duns Scotus is a blessed. Is he a doctor of the church?
No, okay. He's not declared a doctor of the church.
Mm-hmm. His philosophy is considered orthodox. His theology is considered orthodox.
Yeah. And he's not a relativist. I think that's an important thing to say right up from the, he is not saying that, you know, each individual life and the way they live their life, et cetera, is unique to them. And
we're taking it from a 21st century understanding and then placing on Duns Scotus if you do that.
Right. Yeah. No, but what he was saying is that universal category is exemplified in all of the individuals of that category. Yeah. In other words, there's no standard human being that is out there distinct from the individual. There's only the individual human beings that make up what it is to be human.
But does that not contradict fundamentally Thomistic?
You know, I mean, it's certainly.
Does it seem like it?
It does to me. I don't know that it contradicts as much as I think it qualifies to a certain extent. Because, you know, I do not think that St. Thomas would agree that we all have to lose our individuality to become saints. I do not think St. Thomas would disagree that in my becoming more and more Christ-like, I'm not losing, but I'm enhancing my identity as me. And that my ultimate me is not going to be subsumed into some collective you,
right,
and collective Tim, and that when we become saints, we're all going to be alike.
I think that's why there is an appeal to Hiseitas. When Christ was telling his listeners to be perfect as his heavenly Father is perfect, what he wasn't saying is don't sin, because being human, he knows that we do not have a capacity to not sin. It would have been impossible for anybody to live up to. But to be perfect means to be whole or complete, as God is whole and complete. And so I think understanding what it means to be whole and complete as a person means to be true to your nature. It means to be true to reality. It means to be true to your final cause. And all of these things, even with our myriad of differences and woundedness and brokenness, I think the Scotesian philosophy offers room for mercy a lot more, at least in perception, than Thomism would. At least that's the argument from Scotists.
Yeah, and I think there's much broader implications of this formal distinction between the individuals and universals, other than just sort of, I guess, leading up to a personalism, a theological personalism. I think when you look at a lot of society's arguments, they are arguing about that status of the universal concept. Yeah. I mean, when you're looking at the great debate about gender and transgenderism, you're looking at questions that revolve around, okay, so what is it to be male? What is it to be female? What's the relation between being human and being male and being female? And most importantly, what's the relationship between being an individual and being a male and a female? And, as I said, the modern default position is that these are categories that we've come up with and labeled.
Social constructs.
Some of them are social constructs. Some of them are other, just, they're label of a phenomenon that, somebody that can grow a beard and is able to grow muscles and that kind of thing, that's male, and somebody that's not is female. Those are labels that we put on what we know to be male or female. I mean, XY chromosome, right? Somebody that has an XY chromosome is male. Somebody that has, two Y chromosomes are female. We put the label of male or female on those, because all of those share certain characteristics. That's sort of the modern default position. On the flip side, I think you have the Thomistic position that says, no, there are universal categories of male, female, human, etc.
Well, I think it's much older than Thomism.
Much older than Thomism, true. That individual human beings fit within these universal categories as who they are, right? I think this hierarchy of being, the person that some people would argue, Tim, I'll acknowledge you will argue this, and you might be right. He takes it to a logical absurd, but Hegel's, sort of categories of being and his whole structure there is just this dynamic of you are all these different levels of universals all the way down. I think you've got that view on the one hand, but I think Duns Scotus and his formal distinction that there is no maleness and there is no femaleness that doesn't incorporate the individual manifestations of maleness and femaleness. Right. I think that goes a long way in helping us, I think, navigate these two positions within society.
The people of his time thought he was absolutely insane. So to be called a dunce today comes from Duns Scotus.
So the story goes. Yeah. I do sometimes. I'm skeptical of that particular lore.
Oh, I love it, and I'm going to perpetuate it as long as I live.
You Dominican, you. I think this is a topic we need to come back to, though, on the cave a little bit. I mean, there's other elements of Duns. Scotesian philosophy is in vogue now. You talk to university students, and it seems like those that are at a good solid Catholic school and are studying such things. It seems like maybe every other one of them is claiming to be a SCOTUST. And I'm not sure that they understand what that means. And, and I think diving a little bit more into statistics.
It started in the 50s, this ressourcement, this return to the sources, going back to the patristics and other means of orthodox philosophical basis. So Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, was one of the great ones who wasn't necessarily, he had Thomistic beliefs, but he wasn't necessarily a Thomist.
Yep. So we're running out of time here on the Catholic Cave for this week, but I think we'll have to revisit Duns Scotus and Thomas and some of the very 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 fine distinctions between those two philosophical outlooks here on the Catholic Cave. You've been listening to the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.